Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the short Oscar-nominated Netflix film, The Present, Yusuf, a Palestinian father living in the West Bank, takes his daughter out for the day to buy his wife an anniversary gift. He also needs to buy toilet paper and lemons. The film explores the daily struggles of shopping between soldiers, segregated roads, and checkpoints. British-Palestinian filmmaker Farah Nablusi says the film is a PG version of what actually takes place at these checkpoints. She says Israel's occupation of the West Bank means it has control over the movement of about 2.6 million Palestinians in the area. Many go through these checkpoints on a daily basis. She says women give birth there. Women have lost their babies and have lost their lives. Palestinians have died at these checkpoints because they couldn't make it to a hospital or a doctor. Some have also been shot and killed at the checkpoints. According to a new Human Rights Watch report called A Threshold Crossed, Israeli authorities and the crimes of apartheid and persecution throughout the West Bank and Gaza, Israel is the sole governing power. It says across these areas and in most aspects of life, Israeli authorities methodically privilege Jewish Israelis and discriminate against Palestinians. Laws, policies, and statements by leading Israeli officials make plain that the objective of maintaining Jewish-Israeli control over demographics, political power, and land has long guided government policy. In pursuit of this goal, authorities have dispossessed, confined, forcibly separated, and subjugated Palestinians by virtue of their identity to varying degrees of intensity. The report came out right before the 11-day assault on Gaza, which killed at least 254 Palestinians, including 66 children. 11 of those children were part of a Norwegian refugee council program to help them deal with the trauma of growing up under occupation and airstrikes. More than 1,900 Palestinians were wounded. At least 72,000 have been displaced. At least 13 people died in Israel from Hamas rockets, including two children, one of whom was Palestinian. Joining us to talk about what life is like for Palestinians living in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel are two guests. Amjad Iraqi is an editor and writer at 972 Magazine. That's an independent online site run by Israeli and Palestinian journalists. Amjad Iraqi is also a policy analyst at Al Shabaka, an independent think tank whose mission is to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights. Amjad is a Palestinian citizen of Israel based in Haifa, Israel's third largest city. Hi, Amjad. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Rose.
We're also joined by Rifat Alarir, a professor of creative writing and world literature at the Islamic University of Gaza. He's co-editor of Gaza Unsilenced, a book of stories from survivors of Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza. Rifat is also editor and contributor of Gaza Writes Back, short stories from young writers in Gaza, Palestine. On May 13th, Rifat published a piece in the New York Times called My Child Asks, Can Israel Destroy Our Building If the Power Is Out? He and his wife have lost more than 30 relatives from Israeli strikes. In 2014, Rifat lost his brother, Hamada, and he joins us from Gaza City. Hi, Rifat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose, for having me.
Well, thank you, Rifat. I want to start off with you. Thank you for writing this piece, and I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your brother and 30 relatives between you and your wife. You write in this piece that your daughter, Amal, celebrated her sixth birthday during the bombings. Your other eight-year-old daughter, Lena, who you say in Gaza time is 2 wars old, kept asking you and your wife, can they destroy our building if the power is out? And you told her, no, sweetie, they cannot see us in the dark. Yesterday, we spoke with a 23-year-old and a 24-year-old living in Gaza about what it's like to be a young person. Can you talk to us what it's like being a parent in Gaza?
I think being a father, being a parent, means basically providing for the children and providing them, protecting them, and providing them with all the security and the safety they need. And we lack this as Palestinians in general, as people in Gaza in particular, when Israel starts bombing and mowing the grass every couple of years. So it's usually a feeling of despair. Two of my relatives, my wife's relatives, had their homes destroyed in the last Israeli campaign of aggression. And these families, these relatives have kids who happen to be my little daughter's friends. And my little daughters, when they heard about this, that both homes were destroyed and everything was burnt down, they started collecting some of their finest toys and some of their finest clothes. And they told my wife, Nusayba, give these things to the little ones, to Aboud and to Ruqayya. And it's heartbreaking. It's beautiful that kids are selfless, even after, you know, kids. But at the same time, it's heartbreaking because we don't want our children to be thinking of this, of thinking of whose home was destroyed and what part of their clothes and toys to donate to give to out to their friends. Just 3 hours ago, my little Amal again built from her cubes, built a home. And she came and presented it to me. And I spoke about this so many times. The kids have been fascinated with building homes ever since Israel started its, again, latest aggression. So it's devastating because we can't cope up with this because Israel keeps doing it again and again. The feeling of despair, the feeling of inability to provide security for our children and safety and security. And also the impact, the psychological traumas that the kids have to go through, that these experiences that no human being, let alone a child, should go through. So this is basically what it means to be a parent in Gaza.
I listened to an interview you recently gave, and you said that the cameras are on Palestinians when they die en masse. But once the bombs stop falling, people look away. And I've noticed on Twitter, a number of Palestinians are saying, we got so many media requests during the bombardments, but now that there's the ceasefire, the requests have stopped. And I've noticed that it's, you know, we're hearing about what's going on with the Israeli government, but the aftermath of this doesn't get that much attention unless you read a publication like 972, for example. So you said that you have friends and family whose homes were destroyed. What happens after that?
What happens is that they have to wait for, because the real punishment starts after. My family home with seven flats, apartments was destroyed in 2014, and we haven't finished building it yet. Can you imagine this? Like, that's 7 years. So what Israel usually does, again, with American support and European support and, you know, Arab complicity, is that they continue punishing and delaying Palestinians. There is, I'm sure Amjad knows this. There is a report on the website Amjad works for, MAG 7972, about how Israel eventually 80% of the aid that comes to Gaza goes back to Israeli economy, because Israel imposes rules and restrictions on how, what, and where we import. And then the money that comes to Palestinians ends up in Israeli coffers, and it means that Israel is being paid for the occupation, is being rewarded for the occupation. So those people who have their homes destroyed struggle to find a place, struggle to rent a place, and even when they do that, it comes at a higher cost because you're basically uprooted from the memories, the stories you have, the tales you have in this particular place. You lose one of those people is a student of mine, and she contacted me soon after the war, and she said, I lost everything, my books, my notes. How am I supposed to go back to university? So this is what Israel does. It destroys, it kills people, over 260 people, mostly civilians, and it destroys the homes. And at the same time, it kills all these stories and memories, and tries to uproot Palestinians.
That is Rifat Al-Arir, professor of creative writing and world literature at the Islamic University in Gaza. You can see the piece, read the piece that he wrote for the New York Times at our website, yourcallradio.org. He and his wife have lost more than 30 relatives from Israeli airstrikes. In 2014, he lost his brother, Hamada. Amjad, what about you? I mean, have you lost friends and loved ones during these airstrikes over the years?
I mean, the experience is very different for what we describe as Palestinian citizens of Israel, those who've, you know, through luck and chance have been able to stay on the Israeli side of the border and haven't had to experience the kind of severe bombardment that Gaza is forced to go through, or even the military regime that rules the occupied territories. Obviously, you know, during the bombardment of the past few weeks, you know, there are friends and colleagues who either themselves were harmed, who had to flee their homes, whose own relatives were killed or maimed. And, you know, we've had that, if not in this round, certainly in previous rounds as well. Also people that we knew had been lost. So it's not the same experience in that respect in Gaza, but what's been... what's been especially crucial over this past month is that, you know, you don't have to be a Palestinian in Gaza to feel the affinity that we have for the people there. What's been extraordinary about the past few weeks is the extent to which Palestinians from the Gaza to the West Bank, to those inside Israel, to the refugees, to those in the diaspora and all allies with them, have felt this common pulse and really revived this common pulse that says that, you know, whatever happens in Gaza is not just happening in this tiny strip of land. Whatever is happening in Gaza is at the heart of what Palestinians are experiencing under Israeli state violence, under Israeli rule. You might have the most severe forms in Gaza through this kind of wanton bombardment, but you also feel that constant brutal forms of oppression that attempts by the state to consistently remind us that you are not welcome here. That if you're either to return to the cages that we put for you, or you are to be erased, and we see that in different kinds of forms, and in this kind of revival of unity among Palestinians who really come out to the streets, you know, in unison, is to say that, you know, whatever might happen in Gaza, it is always connected to the wider Palestinian question. For a long time, everyone has been fragmenting it and only conceiving it as a war in Gaza, but it's actually a war on all Palestinians on multiple levels.
So you live in Haifa, Israel, Israel's third largest city. And according to Al Jazeera, there are about 1.6 million Palestinians with Israeli citizenship living in Israel. Can you talk about what it's like being a Palestinian citizen of Israel?
Certainly. We certainly have kind of relatively more rights and freedoms than our Palestinian brethren, you know, under blockaded Gaza or those in the occupied West Bank. We have Israeli, blue ID cards and passports and relative freedom of movement, even to go from here into the West Bank, for example. And we have relatively more rights and certain legal protections relative to those who are occupied. But to be a Palestinian citizen of Israel is to inherently be a second-class citizen at best. There are numerous laws dating back to 1948, the establishment of the state, which are inherently designed to ensure that there's Jewish privilege for Jewish citizens, as well as Jews in the diaspora, versus native-born Palestinians who might be born on this side of the Green Line, on the side of the Israeli border, but who are still made to know that they're inferior. For example, there are various laws that restrict the kind of land or homes or property that I can buy because I'm not Jewish. Many of our communities are deliberately segregated and are unable to expand. So even in my hometown in Tira in central Israel, it has not been able to expand for decades, but small Jewish farming communities have been able to pop up in the past 2-3 decades of literally a few hundred people. And this affects, you know, even sometimes the apartments you can try renting out, and people will just say, no, you're Arab and we don't want you. So this, you know, it goes down all the way to where you live. It even hits more severe forms, like even affects your right to marry. So, for example, if I, as a Palestinian citizen, wanted to marry and start a family with a Palestinian from the West Bank or Gaza, who are part of our people in our society, there, I could not extend my citizenship to that spouse and even to the children. There's a law that specifically bans them from doing so. And it's a blanket ban to ensure that Palestinians cannot sort of have these kind of relations. And it's under this rubric of security justifications, quote unquote, but it's actually very much for demographic purposes. Meanwhile, any Jewish person from abroad can instantly come and get citizenship on the basis of being Jewish. So literally from your right to what property you can buy, to who you can marry, to what you can say in public, what you can say even, you know, in the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, and whether you can be disqualified from even political participation. There are countless laws and methods, among many others, that are there to ensure that we cannot express or should not be allowed to express our Palestinian identity, that we may have certainly more better rights than other Palestinians, but we are still there only as second-class citizens.
Are you able to travel freely?
Yes. With an Israeli passport, we can travel abroad through Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. And also, very importantly, we can actually even go over to the West Bank. So, you know, there's often this debate in the United States that there's a lot of assumption that the Green Line is sort of this border that exists between Israel and the Palestinians. But in fact, Israel does control all the territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And that's not just a kind of intellectual idea. It's very much a lived reality and lived experience. So, for example, I can take my blue ID card and my car with its yellow license plate, and I can drive immediately through the Israeli checkpoints without any checks to Ramallah, to Jericho, to Bethlehem, wherever I wish throughout the West Bank. And these are roads primarily that are built for Jewish settlers who live on the occupied territory over there. But because I have these kind of Israeli privileges, so to speak, I can use that to my advantage to connect with Palestinians. And of course, this is denied to Palestinians who are in the West Bank who have green IDs, and certainly to those in the Gaza Strip who are under severe blockade. So a lot of Palestinians like myself try to, you know, we use this relative freedom of movement to be able to you know, keep our connections, even political activism with Palestinians across the Green Line. And this is through that one state reality that we live in and using it to our advantage.
Are you able to travel to Gaza?
No, we cannot, except for very rare exceptions. Since Gaza has been under blockade since 2007, you know, it's the severe restrictions are on people as much as goods. And that's especially for those, you know, trying to leave Gaza. And so those connections, which might have existed, for example, in the 1990s, where there was more open movement, more open kind of checkpoints and borders, that hasn't been the case for well over a decade. And it's very much a deliberate policy to try to separate Gaza from the rest of Palestinians, let alone Palestinian citizens of Israel, but also Palestinians in the West Bank, where it's a very explicit approach by the Israeli state to try to fragment them, to try to think of Gaza as being separate, and to even almost infiltrate the consciousness of Palestinians in the Strip to think of themselves as distinct from the rest of the Palestinian community. That's a challenge.
So as a Palestinian citizen of Haifa, Israel, you can go to the West Bank but cannot go to Gaza. Rifat, you live in Gaza City. Just something as basic as traveling, are you able to go to the West Bank from Gaza?
I'm definitely not. I can't go to Jerusalem. I am 41 years old. I've never been to the West Bank. I've never been to Jerusalem. And this is the case. I've never been to Palestinian areas occupied since 1948. And this is the case with almost 90% of Palestinians. And what Palestinians do here is that sometimes people with severe medical conditions can sometimes, under, you know, also very difficult situations, go to Jerusalem seeking medical treatment. And usually we say these are the lucky ones. And what's worse is that Israel also controls our movement. If you want to go through, like in 2010, I won the full Fulbright scholarship, the most prestigious scholarship, and I had to go through Ares to Jerusalem to do my interview at the American embassy, and Israel said no. And I lost this chance, probably the most important thing for an academic to lose.
I, Rafat, I was watching, you have a YouTube page, right, with some of your creative writing lessons?
Yeah.
I mean, you teach Shakespeare, you teach Othello, you teach Hamlet, and you won a Fulbright scholarship in 2010, and Israel did not let you leave the Gaza Strip to receive your award?
Yeah. I couldn't. I had to wait until like 3 years later when I partly sponsored, paid for my own PhD education, which cost me a lot of money. I'm currently an academic at the Islamic University of Gaza, and I teach poetry and Shakespeare, creative writing also.
How far is Gaza City from Jerusalem? I put it in MapQuest, but it says, sorry, we cannot calculate driving directions.
I think it's a three-hour drive. I think it's a three-hour drive, something like this.
So did you say you're 45?
Yeah, 41.
41, sorry about that. You've never been able to leave Gaza?
I left Gaza, but through Egypt. I did my MA in London and then my PhD in Malaysia. But even in the border with Egypt is also extremely difficult. It's a lot better nowadays, but it's generally a very difficult border to cross.
You know, we had on a Palestinian from Gaza who studied in Chicago. I think it was about 2 years ago, and he can't go back. He said that if he goes back, he probably can't leave again. And so he has to make a really difficult decision. Does he go back and risk never being able to leave again, or does he stay in Chicago away from his family? Is that what most people in Gaza are facing if they want to study abroad?
Yeah. It takes you ages to go to leave. And if you're lucky to leave, it's not easy for you to come back. And this is part of the brain drain that Israel is doing. It's making life very difficult. Unemployment in Gaza is about 50%, and this is crazy. And in the latest aggression, Israel destroyed hundreds of small businesses, startups. 15 of Gaza's largest factories were destroyed by Israel, which means there will be more and more people joining unemployment, being unemployed. So when these people, especially smart people, can't have their own businesses, they usually tend to leave, seek opportunities outside. And those who are lucky to do their education or to have a job abroad are also very cautious, very careful not to come back, because if they come back, they might get stuck and they lose their job or, you know, their work or whatever they have outside.
In the interview that I heard you do, you said that you know small business owners whose businesses have been destroyed over and over again. And at this point, many of them just say, I can't do this anymore. I want to leave.
Yeah, this like happens with so many people, especially like with farmers. And I like to emphasize how Israel is targeting Palestinian farmers and Palestinian laborers in particular, which should be extensively covered. And Palestinian fishermen also, they even during ceasefires, when Palestinians, you know what Palestinians usually say is that during a ceasefire, Palestinians cease or sometimes cease to exist, and Israel fires or continues to fire. So I know people who have had their farms, their olive trees uprooted, destroyed so many times. A friend of mine told me the other day about how Israeli random but systematic bombing destroyed two of his old olive trees that are older than Israel, olive trees that have given olive and olive oil to generations, and now these olive trees are gone. And the same thing applies to people with small businesses and startups, because it's not easy to start a business. It's not easy for somebody who has just finished university, you know, to usually they get a loan from here, they borrow money from there, and all of a sudden everything goes and they find themselves heavily in debt and no job, you know, to help them repay. So this is one of the, some of the most difficult things that Palestinians have to go through. And if there are no jobs, it means less food or no food. And it means people go hungry and will be more dependent on food coupons and aid.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about what life is like for Palestinians living in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel. Rifat Alarir is professor of creative writing and world literature at the Islamic University of Gaza. He's co-editor of Gaza Unsilenced and editor of Gaza Writes Back, short stories from young writers in Gaza, Palestine. He recently published a piece in the New York Times called My Child Asks, Can Israel Destroy Our Building If the Power Is Out? We're also joined by Amjad Iraqi, an editor and writer at 972 Magazine, an independent online magazine run by Israeli and Palestinian journalists. Amjad Iraqi is a Palestinian citizen of Israel based in Haifa, Israel's third largest city. I want to let listeners know that you can email us if you have any questions for Rifat and Amjad. We are short staffed, so we do not have anyone to answer the phones today, but you can email us yourcall@kalw.org or tweet yourcallradio at yourcallradio. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about what life is like for Palestinians living in the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel. Rifat Alarir is joining us from Gaza. He has lost more than 30 relatives from Israeli airstrikes. In 2014, he lost his brother Hamada. He writes about it in a piece he published in the New York Times called My Child Asks, Can Israel Destroy Our Building If the Power Is Out? He teaches creative writing and world literature at the Islamic University of Gaza. Amjad Iraqi is an editor and writer at 972 Magazine, an independent online magazine run by Israeli and Palestinian journalists. Amjad is a Palestinian citizen of Israel based in Haifa. If you have any questions for Rifat or Amjad, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. We are short-staffed today, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls. Amjad, I wanted to also ask you again, you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel. And because you have, did you say it's a blue card?
Yeah, it's a blue ID card and an Israeli passport
as well. Yeah. So a blue ID card, that means you do not have to go through checkpoints in the West Bank?
I mean, inherently, you do have to drive through the checkpoints. So if you're coming from the Israeli side into the West Bank, you'll obviously kind of just see the soldiers, but no one will be stopping you as you enter the West Bank. Bear in mind that a lot of these roads are basically designed to be kind of open roads, specifically for Jewish Israelis to get to settlements in the occupied territories. So a lot of times you won't even know through these roads that you're actually entering occupied territory. It's when you come back, you will, when you're entering from the West Bank to Israel, there'll be a soldier or border police just kind of quickly checking your ID. But if it's blue, then you can go through. If you're green carded Palestinian, then you can't enter.
And can you tell us more about the checkpoints? I mentioned in the introduction the Oscar-nominated Netflix short film called The Present, and it's about Yusuf, a Palestinian father living in the West Bank, who takes his daughter out for the day to do what we all do, buying gifts for loved ones. He also needs to buy toilet paper and lemons. And he has such a difficult time dealing with the checkpoints, soldiers. I mean, at the end of the day, he just absolutely loses it. And the filmmaker Farah Nabulsia, a British Palestinian, says this is actually a PG version of what happens at these checkpoints. In some cases, women give birth at these checkpoints. Women have lost their babies, have lost their lives. Palestinians have been shot and killed at these checkpoints. Can you just give us a sense of what it is like to deal with these checkpoints on a regular basis? I mean, what have you heard from people living in the West Bank?
Definitely. I would highly recommend watching that film. It really is a kind of a very short and PG snippet of what life is like through these, you know, through what are really these sites of structural violence. These checkpoints, you know, it depends whether you have, if you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, like a blue ID, you might be a Jerusalemite Palestinian with a red ID card. And if you're a Palestinian with a green ID card, then you also need like a specific permit that would allow you to get in and out through these checkpoints. The first thing you would notice when you step into these checkpoints is the extent to which there are these militarized structures, soldiers and border police everywhere, heavily armed, surveillance cameras. It is designed to have this very imposing presence. and to intimidate you and to make you feel that you're watched. Usually when you go to these checkpoints, there's no such thing as a quick walkthrough. Whether you're going by car, whether you're going by foot, going through these checkpoints takes ages, regardless of what ID card you have. It can sometimes take you an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, even more, depending sometimes on what the soldiers are feeling like at those crossings. It's there to make life tedious. This is especially crucial in cities, even like certain Palestinian neighborhoods of Jerusalem, where certain neighborhoods are, in fact, on the other side of the concrete separation wall, which you can also see in the film. And these are literally neighborhoods, even families that live across from each other, but which are divided by this wall. And in order to visit each other, you have to go through these military checkpoints and go through the IDs and go through these security checks. Sometimes it might take you to the side for further invasive checkups. Sometimes I'll just randomly take you and will keep you there for like a good hour or two. I've had this happen to me, even when I'm driving a car, even with my blue ID, even with my yellow license plate. It's there to constantly harass. It's a very invasive structure, and every Palestinian has had some experience of it in some form or another. And what's very important to also know about these checkpoints, they're not just laid out along the green line, which is sort of, that little dotted line you'll find on Google Maps, but a lot of these checkpoints are actually inside the occupied West Bank. They are in between Palestinian neighborhoods. They even block Palestinian farmers from accessing their lands, which then become absorbed by Israeli settlements. Some of these checkpoints are permanent, kind of like these permanent objects, permanent structures, but they also have, for example, flying checkpoints that soldiers will just come up and show up one day and decide to put a concrete block or their army jeep and create a checkpoint around a Palestinian village or a Palestinian neighborhood. You can even have that sometimes even among Palestinian communities inside Israel, among Palestinian citizens, especially in times of like escalations or tensions, where they'll form the same kind of system of checkpoints around Arab towns, including my own. So this is a very constant presence to create that sense of engagement, to create that sense of intrusion and harassment. It's a common experience across all Palestinians.
Amjad, since you are a Palestinian citizen of Israel based in Haifa, I mean, it feels odd asking this question, but what are your interactions like with Israelis? What are the conversations like about the recent assaults?
There's always a massive divergence in the way that the two communities interpret the events. Obviously, there's a wide political spectrum in both societies, but oftentimes even your most sort of like center-left Jewish Israeli, even if they, for example, state that they oppose a military occupation or support the Palestinian statehood and whatnot, oftentimes when there's a war around Gaza, they will quickly fall back on this line of, oh, it's Hamas's fault and we have the right to, quote-unquote, defend ourselves, regardless of, the images and the testimonies that are coming out of the Gaza Strip. And very violent, brutal images, or even stories of like Rafat's family, that often doesn't dissuade them. It sort of just falls back into, no, we have the right to do this. And we believe the army and we believe that this is right, whether we like it or not. That's kind of oftentimes your best case scenario with, most center-left Jewish Israelis, excluding more radical-left Jewish Israelis who are very much allied with Palestinians on this. And even that kind of center-left Jewish Israeli spectrum is rapidly shrinking. Most of Jewish Israeli society today, for the past decade, two decades, has unfortunately become much more right-wing, much more nationalist, much more intolerant even of hearing Palestinian perspectives, or even thinking about the idea of Palestinian humanity and Palestinian freedom. I remember this, two decades ago when I was like a young student, even some of the Jewish Israeli friends that I had, even if they kind of tried to sympathize with you, they would still fall back into those lines. And they might agree to kind of even give you certain kinds of rights and agree that there might be forms of racism and military brutality. But oftentimes when push comes to shove, you'll find that they might prefer the quote unquote status quo, because inherently the way that things are structured now gives Jewish Israelis political and social supremacy from the river to the sea. And even if you put the question of the occupation aside, you know, like what we witnessed over the past few weeks is the extent to which the state, by through police, through even attempted lynch mobs, tried to also attack Palestinian citizens. And, you know, these center-left Jewish Israelis might not necessarily might not agree with that, but even when you have them on a regular day-to-day conversation, you know, they might agree to give you certain rights and give you certain protections, but they would still often demand this this element of Jewish privilege, that in order to maintain the Jewish state, we need to have certain policies and practices which require you as a Palestinian citizen to accept being a constant suspect, to force you to accept that you have to be somewhat inferior in your citizenship. That requires us to keep Palestinians in the occupied territories at bay. We don't want them coming into the state. We need them to stay on the other side of the wall. Like, this is your best case scenario. And of course, then you have your, you know, the majority of the side unfortunately goes actually much further to the right, which wants to keep those cages, which wants that our Palestinian inferiority very much explicitly clear through laws, through policies, through rhetoric. And, you know, and this is the reality even in a city like Haifa, which is often touted as a sort of city of coexistence. But over the past few weeks, the police were invading Palestinian homes, brutally repressing Palestinian protests, even though we're theoretically supposed to have the right to demonstrate. But the police went all out against us. Even the fact when there were like kind of these far-right lynch mobs that were trying to attack Palestinian citizens, trying to destroy their properties, the police would either stand idly by or actually join them in attacking these properties and attacking these Palestinian citizens. So the state itself is very clear about where its allyship lies, and it's with the Jewish majority. And a lot of even some Jewish Israeli friends of mine, people that I knew, didn't believe us when we were saying that we were waiting for these mobs to come, worried that they were about to invade our homes. They thought we were exaggerating. But, you know, you ask every Palestinian, they experience this, they record this, they document this. So unfortunately, we live in very different realities. We might live in the same state and have the same ID cards and live in the same cities, but the realities are so different.
Amjad Iraqi is an editor and writer at 972 Magazine, an independent online site run by Israeli and Palestinian journalists. Amjad is a Palestinian citizen of Israel based in Haifa. We're also joined by Rifat Al-Arir, professor of creative writing and world literature at the Islamic University of Gaza. He's co-editor of Gaza Unsilenced and editor of Gaza Rights Back. He wrote a New York Times op-ed recently called "My Child Asks, Can Israel Destroy Our Building If the Power Is Out?" We're short-staffed today, so we cannot take your calls, but you can email your call at kalw.org. We are getting a lot of emails about Hamas. Bill writes, "My heart goes out to the Palestinians, especially those in Gaza, but their rulers, Hamas, know that any attack on Israel will result in a hugely disproportionate reaction." I first want to note an op-ed in the New York Times written by Basma Galayini called "A Gazan's View on Hamas, It's Not Complicated." She writes that after the Bush administration foisted elections upon Gaza in 2006, Hamas was elected only because people thought it would be less corrupt than the mainstream secular party Fatah. But she writes, "We do not get elections every 4 years in Gaza, and Hamas's victory was something that Gazans soon learned to regret. We have not had a chance to vote Hamas out of power. 2006 was the last election we had. That's why to focus on Hamas is to miss the point and to reinforce the myth that the conflict is in some fundamental manner about the group. The conflict is about the Israeli occupation." So why don't you comment on this first, Rifat? A lot of emails about Hamas. Bill says, "Why does Hamas keep repeating this pattern, and do the inhabitants of Gaza have any influence on this pattern?"
I thank you for citing Basma's important piece. This is a very interesting thing, and Israelis are never asked about, you know, what the Israeli army does, the billions it gets, the weapons, the destruction, the massacres it commits against Palestinians. So it's always the Palestinians, the colonized, the oppressed people, the besieged people who are asked why are you defending yourselves with what little you have? So what Hamas does is that it resists Israeli aggression. Not only Hamas, and also just focusing on Hamas is wrong because there are other Palestinian factions who resist Israeli aggression with whatever means they have, homemade rockets or whatever. And we need to look at the Palestinian resistance, especially armed resistance, in the wider context of the Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid. Israel is a racist settler colonial entity that has oppressed Palestinians, not last week or last month, not last 10 years ago or 20 years ago. This started in 1948 with the destruction of Palestine, Palestinian, over 400 Palestinian villages Israel destroyed, the establishment of Israel destroyed before and after. Israel displaced close to a million Palestinians and made them refugees in other places of occupied Palestine or in the diaspora. And it's very important to understand that there are no rockets in Jerusalem. There are no rockets in the West Bank. There is barely any armed resistance in the West Bank. There's barely any, you know, Hamas activity in the West Bank. And yet, during the same period that Israel massacred close to 260 Palestinians, it killed 30 Palestinians in the West Bank. So what Palestinians understand is that if you do nothing, you will be killed. You will be oppressed. Your land will be taken away. If you throw stones, you will be killed. You will be punished. Your home will be destroyed. If you react, if you have a weapon and you shoot at Israeli soldiers, you will be killed. You will be also punished in the way Israel does. And so if we are, this is what many Palestinians think, if we are dead anyway, why not use what we can have in order to resist this Israeli brutality? And many Palestinians in Gaza, they are convinced, and this is partly true. The Israeli settlements were, the Israeli Jewish settlers were kicked out of Gaza because partly of the Palestinian armed struggle. And Palestinians see, if you look at the West Bank, there is barely a West Bank now because Israel is, the Israeli Jewish settlers are stealing Palestinian land every day. Look at what's happening in the West Bank. Palestinians are not resisting, are not shooting, are not firing rockets. Still, there are, I'm not sure how many, but over, I think, 700 Israeli settlers, Jewish settlers in Jerusalem and the West Bank are expanding day by day, coming from America, from Europe, from Brazil, from around the world, taking Palestinian homes and livelihoods and destroying the everything. So no matter what Palestinians do, they will be killed, their homes will be destroyed, their fields will be uprooted, because this is what every occupation does. Saying it's Hamas' fault is, again, what Israel does, what every colonial entity did before, blaming the victim for what, this is what I say, blaming the victim for even shouting, for whimpering as they are being massacred. So people in Palestine, in Gaza, particularly, believe that. And that's why so many people came around the resistance recently, not only in Gaza, but in occupied Palestine and even around the world, because they believe that if the resistance is not doing this, Israel is going to exterminate Palestinians in Gaza. Israel is going to displace Palestinians like it is displacing Palestinians everywhere. So it's wrong to say, if anybody who says Hamas, this is starting the story from second. And this is what Israel wants. There is first to the story. If you start the story from second, you will always blame the victim. There is always first. There's the occupation that has to end. There is the apartheid that has to end.
Amjad, what would you add about Hamas? Because almost every question we're getting is about Hamas. Karen writes, what do they think of Hamas rockets bombarding Israel? Do they think that Israel would have bombarded Gaza if Hamas didn't bombard Israel first?
I mean, the first thing is to echo that Hamas was founded in the late 1980s. The military occupation of West Bank and Gaza started in 1967. And the Nakba, the forced expulsion and uprooting of Palestine, happened in 1948. So there's actually more Palestinian history without Hamas than there is Palestinian history with Hamas. And so here I want to echo Rafat in that, like, you know, while it's certainly an important actor today, there needs to be a recentering of the bigger picture here. And I want to echo again, I mean, the second point I want to raise is that Palestinians are among the first to debate the role of Hamas, from its Islamist ideology to its use to what it described as armed resistance, even those who criticize, you know, the fact that it kind of indiscriminately fires rockets. This is debated among the community. But there's a different understanding of what, you know, that this movement itself is a symptom and is a product of the environment and the context in which it operates. I would definitely recommend, you know, for those want to do more reading, there's a fantastic analyst named Tariq Bakaouni, who's a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group. He recently did a podcast on Crisis Group, and also I had the pleasure of interviewing him a few weeks ago to try to make people understand where this movement is coming from, whether or not you agree with it, but to kind of extend at least some nuanced understanding of how this group emerged, where it stands in Palestinian politics, and to understand it as this product of the regime that Rafat was articulating. And again, you don't have to be some kind of supporter of Hamas to understand where it's coming from. A second point, and I think, and this is also just being said, but what we're seeing at the level of Palestinian national politics, as Rafat said, is that it doesn't matter actually what kind of tactic you do. So right now you have in Gaza Hamas, which is very much committed to this idea of armed resistance. In the West Bank, you have the Palestinian Authority led by Fatah, which is deeply committed to a diplomatic process, to you know, also the quote-unquote peace process with the Israeli authorities, with American patronage, etc. So it's going about it the quote-unquote nonviolent route. What we're finding, what we found over the past many years, is that, as Rafat said, it doesn't matter which approach you're going for. You could rid Hamas and the occupation would still be there. And you can try the Palestinian Authority approach, but what you'll find is exactly that the apartheid regime that we're seeing is only entrenching. So the idea that somehow Hamas, which is one part of a larger ecosystem of Palestinian politics and Palestinian experience, is the issue, is simply not correct. Even if you got rid of the occupation tomorrow, for example, what about Palestinian citizens of Israel, who have an entire legal system that is geared against them to make them unequal? So those are essentially the two elements, is to remember that Hamas is an important player, but to understand from a nuanced perspective of why this movement operates. And I really encourage the resources I suggested and to understand where it's coming from. And even on a policy level, just to understand for people, you know, even as indiscriminate as rocket fires are, they are a tactic of military intervention. And you can completely disagree with and reject it. And Palestinians are also among the people to debate that. But to understand it through that lens, if you also understand other militant groups, other groups that use armed resistance, you know, throughout history and throughout the modern era, we need to apply that same knowledge productions to understand where it's coming from. And also in the United States, especially at a time where you're literally having the government, for example, negotiate with different kinds of militia groups all across the world, including places like Afghanistan, which most people think is inconceivable, that should also apply to Hamas. Of engagement. And in fact, the Israeli authorities are the first to constantly engage with Hamas and have those connections. So this idea that we don't speak with quote unquote terrorists is also a bit of a fallacy. So we need to have that that nuanced understanding of the movement and to put it back in its central place, and to say that, again, you can even try to oppose the movement or reject the movement, try to create a different kind of political identity and political system. But as long as the Israeli regime operates the way it does, as long as it's still intent on suppressing Palestinians, no matter what kind of resistance they do, no matter what way they try to assert their identity, that is the fundamental problem in the end.
And where does this leave Palestinians? Palestinians in Gaza, for example, Rafat, we have just about a minute and a half left.
We go back to something very important mentioned by Amjad. The Israeli total control of Palestinian lives, every aspect. We were expecting an election. But who said no to the election? Who vetoed this election? Israel. So Israel doesn't want Palestinians because Israel said no. Palestinians in Jerusalem cannot vote. You can't bring the election, the polls here to Jerusalem. So there was no no election. The Palestinians in Gaza are part again of the Palestinians everywhere. In Haifa and in Akka and Lid, in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, in Nablus, and Hebron, and people in the diaspora. All we want is an end to this brutal occupation. But first, we need an end to this siege that is suffocating us. We need more pressure from the amazing global solidarity that took the millions that took to the street to put more pressure on their politicians to boycott Israel. BDS to boycott Israel and Israeli services and companies that benefit from the Israeli occupation. With this in mind, hopefully in the future, Palestinians everywhere can have a hope of living in peace without Israeli apartheid suffocating them.
Rifat Al-Arir is professor of creative writing and world literature at the Islamic University of Gaza. He's co-editor of the book Gaza Unsilenced and editor of Gaza Writes Back, short stories from young writers in Gaza, Palestine. You can read his piece that was published in the New York Times recently called My Child Asks, Can Israel Destroy Our Building If the Power Is Out? Rifat says that he uses literature to empower young people in his classes. Rifat, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the New York Times piece you wrote.
Thank you for having me.
Amjad Iraqi is an editor and writer at 972 Magazine, an independent online website run by Israeli and Palestinian journalists. Amjad Iraqi is a policy analyst at Al-Shabaka, an independent think tank whose mission is to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights. He's a Palestinian citizen of Israel based in Haifa, Israel's third largest city, and you can read Amjad's writing at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Amjad, and thank you for your writing.
Thanks for having us, Rose.
Thank you, and thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.